Okay, great. Thanks, Christina. Thanks for the invitation, first of all. It's a great pleasure to be here. So today I want to tell you about some work I did in collaboration with this fantastic set of collaborators. So Alberto Nicolis is at Columbia, Lucas Antoni is in Paris now, and Austin Joyce is in Chicago. And the theme will be relativistic superfluids. In the first part, I will present work appeared in this paper. And in the second part, I will try to elaborate on the connection between finite density and spontaneous symmetry breaking for scalar fields. And this is an upcoming paper which should be out in a matter of days. So, first of all, please interrupt me and ask questions. I'm happy if the seminar is interactive, so feel free to interrupt me any time. But before going to the technical part, I want to give you some introduction on why relativistic superfluids are an interesting system, both from a theoretical and from a physical point of view. So the superfluid phase is a phase of matter which is characterized can be characterized in terms of symmetry, and this is characterized by the spontaneous breaking of time translation and together with an internal symmetry in such a way that a diagonal combination of the Hamiltonian and the internal charge is linearly realized on the ground state of the system. However, since the ground state of the system is a finite density state for the internal charge, what happens is that this ground state defines a preferred reference system, which is the rest frame of the superfluid. And as a consequence, since we have a preferred rest frame, boost invariance is always spontaneously broken in superfluids. And so, in particular, we have spontaneously broken time and charge together with spontaneously broken boost invariance. So, you might expect that in this theory you need a lot of Gladstone bosons to nonlinearly realize these symmetries. However, the nonlinear realization of space-time symmetries is more subtle than that of internal symmetries. And it's been known for a long time, starting from work of Ivanov Ogevetsky in the 70s, that in the case of space-time spontaneous broken space-time symmetries, one can impose so-called inverse X constraints, which are relations between Gladstone fields, which allow you to realize non-linearly more than one space-time symmetries using a lower number of Gladstone fields. And in particular, in the case of the superfluid, you can realize non-linearly all these symmetries using just one Gladstone boson, which represents the superfluid phonons. So this is the general theoretical definition of a superfluid that we'll be using. And superfluids are interesting physical systems for a number of reasons. My brief summary is that, first of all, they describe a fascinating phase of condensed matter physics, so maybe we should be interested in them. It's a phase which is purely quantum mechanical, so it has very interesting emergent properties. But more from a high energy theory point of view, relativistic superfluids are also important in cosmology as they can play a role as cosmological fluids both in inflation and even with some proposals could even play a role in exotic phases of dark matter. And moreover, they could be a phase which is realized in the core in the inner core of neutron stars. So maybe they are of interest for physical nature. But from a more theoretical point of view, they are also interesting because they are related to the large charge sector of conformal field theories. And in particular, the scaling dimensions and OP coefficients of large charge operators in conformal field theories can be related to the effective field theory of a superfluid through the so-called state operator correspondence. And this last viewpoint has seen a lot of activities in the last 5 years. So I will comment on this at the end of the talk if I have time. So, in my talk, I will consider relativistic superfluids. Relativistic superfluids are an essential ingredient if you want to couple them to gravity, as it's as one has to do in the case of the context of cosmology. And moreover, I will focus on the zero temperature case. I will mostly restrict to 3 plus 1, but I will also comment on superfluids in different dimensionalities. And if one is interested in laboratory systems of non-relativistic condensed matter, non-relativistic superfluids, one can always take the non-relativistic limit at the end. And we did a number of checks about this. I don't know if I have time to talk about this, but if you're interested, please ask and I can tell you more.
Yeah, may I ask right away?
Yes.
Yes, I'm just wondering, so in condensed matter systems, the boosts are broken by the lattice, kind of explicitly.
So
Would you still recover? Yes, so I wonder how general this is. Okay, I understand that you can take it, you get some non-relativistic system, but is it kind of any non-relativistic system we can have in the lab, or something more?
It depends a bit of what systems you're considering. For instance, in helium, it's known that low temperature you don't have a lattice. You really have a superfluid phase. So in this, in kind, for instance, in superfluid helium, you really have the symmetry breaking pattern that I described. So it's not you don't have the lattice.
Right. Yeah, when I think about us, yeah, it's all superconductors, I'm thinking. So there, what would you get them as well?
Superconductor.
Yeah.
Well, superconductor is very similar to the symmetry breaking pattern I described. It's just that the internal symmetry is gauged. So also there, I think you quantum mechanically, you're not allowed to talk about a grid of atoms. They have some collective behavior, which is described by this kind of symmetry breaking pattern.
No, I mean, yeah, okay, I
Let
see.
me also.
Okay, we still treat it as spontaneously broken,
Yes,
say.
booster still non-trivial. Let me, yeah, and just one more comment. There are also helium-4 is a superfluid, which is, as far as we understand, whose UV completion is strongly coupled. However, there are also experimental systems, which are called atom systems, in which people were able to realize experimentally weakly interacting condensates of Bose particles. And these are more similar to the kind of superfluids I will be talking about in this talk. But I can tell you more if you're interested. Yes, please.
Question. We're taking superfluids after a threshold. I think the superfluidity will be broken, right?
Well, it's so yeah. As you spin superfluid, you start exciting first phonons and then vortices, and then at some point you go outside of the regime of validity of the effective field theory I'm describing. So in this talk, I will focus on non-spinning superfluids.
Because in
But
generalization to the curved spacetime relativistic superfluid, inherently you may use some rotation, for instance, in the stationary spacetime around a curved spacetime.
Of course. I understand what you're saying. I think what I mean by relativistic is in Minkowski space in this talk. I will not talk about superfluids in black hole space-time, for instance. But I think that what you're saying is right. But in this talk, I will focus just on superfluids which are relativistic but are set in Minkowski space-time. Okay, so from the symmetry description of superfluids that I gave you in the first slide, it's been known for a long time, since the seminal work of Dantan Son, that the most general effective action to describe the phonons of the superfluid is given by this simple expression at leading order in derivatives, which is just the action for the superfluid phonons, psi, is captured by by an arbitrary function of x, where x is a scalar Poincaré scalar built from a scalar field theta, which can be thought as intuitively as the phase, if you want, of a complex field, for instance, where this field, theta, has a linear, has a background profile which is linearly dependent on time, and the coefficient in front is what people then call, well, you can show that it's identified with the chemical potential, and different values of the chemical potential will correspond to different values of the density for this superfluid state. And moreover, it will become important later in what I say, but this function p of x is actually related to the equation of state, to the physical equation of state of the superfluid. And in this kind of theories, the pattern of symmetry breaking is exactly the one I talked about in the first slide. So with this parameterization, both there are both an internal U1 symmetry and time translations, which are both realized nonlinearly on the Fonon field pi. And a combination of them is unbroken, since you can always compensate a time translation by an internal symmetry, an internal shift. And this pi, as I was saying, is the degree of freedom which describes the superfluid form. Okay? So here I'm working at the level of one derivative per field, but I'm keeping this function keeps all orders in the field. So, since the superfluid DFT is obtained by expanding around this background, it means that this variable x is expanded around some given value of mu square. And this value is an input, is the value of the density I'm considering. It's related to the density I'm considering for the superfluid. So since we want to be able to describe the Fonon fields for a superfluid at arbitrary densities, it means that this function has to be given not just as a power series around one single point, but we need to know the full functional form of this function p of x. And the expansion, the derivative expansion is controlled by ratios of derivatives to the mass of UV fields and possibly the chemical potential if we integrate out heavy modes which have a gap of order the chemical potential. And as I was saying, we would like to know this p of x to all orders in x, okay? So let me compare just yes.
I have a question. How come, so U1 and time translations are two symmetries?
Yes.
You can only quantify them by one constant.
Sorry? Both of them act in this way, where time translation evolves a parameter, which is the time shift. So the internal symmetry just shifts pi by constant.
Okay.
You can show that is a symmetry of this action. And time translation shifts this theta field and also the pi field by a mu times delta t. So both act as a shift. And so you can compensate them. So there is a diagonal combination which is unbroken. Yes?
I'm just wondering yourself, so the symmetry defines superfluid in this context?
Yes. Yeah, it's the symmetry characterization of superfluidity. You can show that the usual definitions are equivalent to this one. Okay, just to make some connection with maybe what is more familiar to many of us from a particle physics background, I want just briefly to comment on the comparison between what I just said to the more maybe familiar case of Lorentz invariant theories for Goldstones of an internal symmetry. So if you have, for instance, a Goldston for a spontaneously broken U1, usually you just write an effective action for this for the pion, for the Goldston, as a derivative expansion in pi. And usually you just care about the coefficients of a few operators in this derivative expansion. And the reason for this is that usually the vacuum state is described by a state in which the background of the pion of the Fonon is zero. So you can just consider the Taylor expansion around that background. And so at low energies, if you have a finite experimental accuracy, you only care about a finite number of terms in this expansion, and you can just fix a finite number of coefficients. However, in the previous slide, as I was saying, depending on the density of the system or the superfluid, we will be expanding this function around different points. So in this case, we cannot just define the effective field theory as a power series expansion around one point. So we need to find the full functional form of P of X if you want to be able to extract some meaningful physics. Okay. So how do we derive an effective field theory for the phonons? Well, usually in the path integral approach to quantum field theory, we like to think about effective field theories as effective actions which are derived from integrating out heavy fields. So this is the naive intuition that we have when we talk about quantum and effective field theories. And usually the meaning of this is that you can write some effective Lagrangian for the light fields, for the light degrees of freedom, which reproduces correlators of the light fields in the same way as the full action would, giving you the same answers that the full action would give. However, this is a bit of a naive way to define the effective action, because in general, we don't know how to perform the path integral over the heavy fields for arbitrary field configurations. So this is not a very concrete way to define what the effective action for the light fields is. And usually, what we do in practice is consider a derivative expansion for the low energy effective field theory. However, the low energy expansion changes the structure of UV divergences. In particular, if you take the propagator of an heavy field, after doing a derivative expansion, the structure of divergences changes completely. So this is a subtlety one must take into account when integrating out heavy fields. And usually this, yeah, please. Yeah,
but I guess below the threshold where the EFT is valid, those divergences will not apply.
Yeah, now I'm asking, how do you derive the EFT? Suppose you have a UV theory.
Okay, sorry.
With some heavy fields, how do you derive the EFT? I'm trying to describe how to derive this P of X from a UV theory. Okay, and so usually in Lorentz invariant theories, since we just need the finite number of coefficients, what we do to derive the effective field theory is to write the most general function of the most general effective field theory in the derivative expansion, and then match the coefficients by doing some computing some correlators or S matrix, both in the effective field theory and in the full theory, and matching the coefficients. However, in the case I described before, this is not, we cannot do this because we will need an infinite number of coefficients. We don't just need a few coefficients in the derivative expansion, but we need to know the full functional form. So this prescription is not useful in the case of superfluids. So how do we do? Well, a possible strategy to compute the effective theory to all orders in the light fields, but to a fixed order in the derivative expansion, was put forward in the 90s by Georgi, but was never, he proposed this definition, but he never carried out explicit computations. But still, this definition can be quite effective in defining what we mean by the effective theory for the light fields. And basically, the prescription is the following. You can think of computing the effective action, gamma, quantum effective action, both in the UV theory and in the effective theory. For the one PI for the light fields, and you can think of matching the quantum effective actions computed both in the UV and in the effective description. So what I will do in the first part of this talk is carry out this computation explicitly at one loop for a relativistic field theory, and as I was saying, I will work at first order in derivatives, but to all orders in the light field. So we'll find the full functional form of these effective actions. So matching these two computations will give us the P of X in an explicit UV completion. And then I will try to extract physical statements from this computation and pose some questions, which I will address in the second part. Okay. So the simplest weakly coupled UV completion you can think for a superfluid Here I'm working in 3+1 dimensions. The simplest example is a complex scalar field with some internal U1 symmetry and with a lambda phi to the fourth interaction. So one can consider two cases. The case in which m squared is positive. In this case, spontaneous symmetry breaking in finite density happen when the chemical potential is larger than the mass at the classical level. You can see that if you try to insert these ansatz for the background, the effective potential, the potential for phi is destabilized when mu is larger than m. And so there is spontaneous symmetry breaking together with finite density. Whereas for m squared negative, there is always spontaneous symmetry breaking, both at finite and zero density. Most of the talk will actually focus on this scenario, but I will comment on this later. And as I was saying, theta is the phase of this, can be thought as the phase of this complex field, and it will be associated to the phonon. Whereas rho, the radial mod, will be heavy and will be integrated out. Okay. So we can write this action in polar coordinates. Now the action depends explicitly on theta only through the combination x equal d theta squared. And so integrating out rho, we will obtain an expansion, naturally obtain an expansion in x and derivatives of x. But since we are interested in working at one derivative per field, it means that we are working by only keeping terms which depend on x and dropping the terms which depends on derivatives of x. So we can do the one loop computation can be done in a way which is analogous to the Coleman-Weinberg computation. One can check that the path integral measure by going doesn't change in dim reg by going from Cartesian to polar coordinates. I won't have time to go into too much details. But basically, to compute the one loop quantum effective action in the UV theory, we do the usual approach of the Coleman-Weinberg effective potential. So we take a background and consider perturbations. And then we try to compute the path integral by keeping 1PI diagrams for the fluctuations. And we need to do this both at tree level and at one loop. So at tree level, you can just solve the classical equations of motions and plug back. And you find that by dropping derivatives of x, the only solutions are rho. Well, rho is the radial mod, they're only rho equals zero or rho equals x minus m squared over lambda. And the second one is the ground state for x larger than m squared, as I was saying. And one finds that the p of x tree level is given simply by this expression. And this was found a few years ago in papers dealing with cosmology, thinking about superfluids in the cosmological context. But now we want to compute one loop corrections. So we consider the background plus fluctuations. An arbitrary background plus fluctuations. And we consider the quadratic Lagrangian. And you can play some tricks, rewrite the things in a covariant looking way, even if this d mu theta, even if theta will have a background which chooses just time. But you can still think of writing things in a covariant looking way. It's like having a spurion. And in this way, you can organize the computation in such a way you just have a quadratic action with some differential operators. And you can go to frequency space and compute the one loop integrals. I will not go into the details, but if you're interested, I can tell you. And then computing the determinant coming from this one loop path integral, you arrive at this expression for the one loop contribution to the quantum effective action UV theory. And you, on the first line, you have some divergent terms. On the second and third line, you have some finite contributions. And first of all, a non-trivial check is the fact that the divergent terms now we are working at finite chemical potential, these divergent terms are exactly those that you will get in the mu equals zero theory. So the ordinary counter terms that you would input in the UV theory at zero chemical potential are already sufficient to renormalize the theory and cancel all divergences. So this is what you would expect physically. And then we are left with some finite contributions, which I will rewrite in the MS-bar scheme. Notice that here we have this MF is a combination which includes X and M squared, but basically we can think of it as being X. So this function has some very non-trivial, if you want, non-analytic dependence on X. There is a log because when you send the radial mod, so the non-analyticity associated with this log is associated with the fact that the radial mode becomes massless for MF that goes to zero. And this is a special function, which is an hypergeometric function. So in this way, basically, we have found the full P of X, not just as a polynomial series expansion, but as a full analytic, with its full analytic dependence. Okay. Now, this was the computation in the UV theory. Now we need to match it with the computation in the effective theory. One can show that if you start from this P of X, then you expand the quadratic order, you do exactly the same procedure I described before. Yes. Yes. Lambda is in the first. So notice that the tree level is 1 over lambda. So the one loop is. Yeah, exactly. So the one loop is. So mu is x squared, is mu squared plus fluctuations. So theta is mu t pi plus pi.
At this point, we just calculated the effective action for the theta, right? But we still have to assume that it has this specific form. Is that right? For integration.
Sorry, what do you mean? Well, I'm assuming here. I'm assuming to choose this solution. I'm assuming that X is larger than M squared. So I'm assuming that the background of theta is such that X is large enough. So in particular, theta linear in time is.
Effective action for theta in this particular form.
Yes. No, mu is arbitrary, but I'm assuming that it's non-zero and that it satisfies this condition. Okay. Yes. Yeah, we'll discuss this in a second. Let me go on, and then you, if you're not satisfied with what I will say later, you will ask again. You can ask again. In the effective theory, it turns out that one loop quantum effective action is equal to the tree level. This is a statement in DIMREG. And so basically, the effective action that I showed you before can be identified exactly with the P of X. So after renormalizing in the MS bar, we obtain this result. So the P of X coming from this lambda phi to the fourth theory with a U1 symmetry is given by this expression. The first line is the tree level. The second line is the one loop. And as you can see, since I was renormalizing in the MS bar scheme, we have some sliding scale, mu bar, the MS bar ordinary normalization scale. And so it looks like, it will look like that this function has some kind of running. However, this is not possible because P of X, as I was saying, evaluated on the background, X equal mu square, is associated to the equation of state of the superfluid, which is a physical quantity. So this quantity should be a renormalization scale independent. Okay. And the reason why this the scale dependencies appearing here is that I was using MS-bar defined mass and coupling. I was not using physical coupling in giving this expression. It turns out, I'm not showing the details because they're not super illuminating, but you can find them in the paper. If you re-express this result in terms of physical couplings, in particular if you take the pole mass and the scattering amplitude threshold as a definition of quartic coupling, then all the dependence on mu bar cancels non-trivially, and this function is a randomization scale independent. Okay, so this is a non-trivial check, consistency check of what we are doing.
So
are you saying the log cancels completely, or? No. The log does not cancel. Right. Just mu bar.
Right. So what is mu bar?
Basically, m square or stuff like this. Yes. I can show you the expression. It's in the paper, but since it's not super illuminating, I didn't. Okay. No. It's the same level of complication. Okay, now we can generalize this computation to the case of an ON model. So instead of taking one complex scalar, you take n real scalars. And then you can introduce a chemical potential for an SO2 inside this SON. And you can repeat the same computation, but now there will be additional states, which are gapped. And it turns out that there are n-2 gapped states, which have gap fixed by the chemical potential. This is a non-perturbative result, which was proven in this paper. And you can also integrate out these states in addition to the radial mod. And what you find is that the P of X for this ON model is exactly that of the U1 model, plus the correction coming from the n-2 gapped Gaussians. And the properties I was mentioning before are still valid in this theory. Okay, and now with these results, we can try to derive some physical consequences. So first of all, we can think of taking the identity limit of this P of X. And we can use the RG to resum the logs in the base where we don't use the physical couplings. This is the beta function. We can resum and express the identity limit of the P of X in terms of the renormalized coupling. And if you take this P of X, you can compute the sound speed for the phonons. So you will, if you expand the action around background plus perturbations, you find that the phonons propagate with a non-trivial sound speed. And the sound speed is given by this combination, this functional dependence on the P of X. And you find that in this identity limit, the sound speed is 1/3 plus a correction. The 1/3 comes from the fact that this P of X is almost that of a conformal superfluid. So a conformal superfluid in 4 dimensions has P of X proportional to X squared. You can show that that's conformally invariant. However, here this coupling is running, so this induces scaling violations. And it turns out that since this beta function is positive, the correction is positive. And this is not something that we were aware of, that we were not aware that it would be possible to have relativistic superfluids with speeds, sound speeds larger than 1/3. So we thought this was kind of interesting. And you can reproduce this result more formally considering the trace anomaly of the stress energy tensor. So I will skip this for the sake of time. Yeah, no, it's nothing inconsistent, but usually, no, this is 1/3, it's not 1.
No, but the term on the right is positive, right? So that can be large. So
well, when lambda is large, when this becomes of order 1/3, then you lose control of perturbation theory. So it's not, this is always smaller than 1.
In this case, where you have some constant
motor quadratic dispersion. Sorry, I didn't hear.
In this case, where you have some constant motor quadratic dispersion.
Yeah, at low energy. That's a low energy statement. The quadratic behavior is in the limit of low. You're thinking about expanding around low k, right?
I'm asking about the dispersion of the Gaussian number. Is it proportional to the momentum of the moment square?
So in this case, you have a sound speed, so it's proportional to the momentum. It's just like the relativistic dispersion, but with the sound speed instead of speed of light. It depends. It depends on the model. It's model dependent. It's not a universal state. There are type. They're called type one and type two Gaussian bosons, and you can have both of them. It depends on the system. In this case, you find this.
Only linear dispersion.
In this case, you find linear dispersion.
That's violating some statements of how you want to map on
that. No, I think this is the general. I think for superfluids, you always get this. But we can chat about this later. Okay, but let me go on because I want to tell you about something else. So the second physical statement we can try to extract is the following. So for positive M square, as I said you at the beginning, at the classical level, finite density and spontaneous symmetry breaking only occur when mu is larger than M, the bare mass. So one can wonder what happens at one loop. So one can check when is the effective theory for these phonons consistent. In order for it to be consistent, you have to ask that it's stable and that the perturbations are subluminal. And these conditions for arbitrary values of mu square implies these two conditions on P, on the P of X. And you can show that this condition translates in the following statement, that X, or rather mu square, is larger than this value. And it turns out that this particular combination is exactly the pole mass of the mu equals zero theory. So it looks like that a finite density phase with superfluidity is only well described when mu is larger than the pole mass. Okay. And moreover, if you take the low density limit where X goes to the pole mass, and you compute the density from the energy momentum tensor, you find that the density is going to zero as well. So it looks like that there is a physical threshold. It looks like that when you take the superfluid and you send its density to zero, and you consider the low density limit, then the density is going to zero at this physical value of the chemical potential. So this made us wonder about the following. Is there a relation between spontaneous symmetry breaking at finite density? Is it true that if I take a scalar field theory at finite density, I also break spontaneously the internal symmetry for the charge I'm putting at finite density? So let me talk about this. So consider a complex scalar, phi, with some internal U1 symmetry. And imagine putting the system at finite density for some internal charge, for the internal charge associated to the U1. So this means that we are considering a state in which this component of the current has a non-zero expectation value. Now I'm asking, is it always true that when this is non-zero, the expectation value of phi is non-zero? Or is it possible to have a non-zero expectation value for the current with zero expectation value for the field? So at the classical level, there is no real mystery. Because for free bosons, it's well known that the ground state at finite density always exhibits spontaneous symmetry breaking. This is the well-known phenomenon of Bose-Einstein condensation. However, we are not aware of any proof that this statement has to be true in the presence of interactions. If you think about quantum field theory, these two objects are two different operators. They have different quantum numbers. One is a scalar and its charge. The other is a component of a vector and a zero charge. So there is no clear reason why the expectation value of one should control the expectation value of the other. So this made us wonder if you can establish some kind of connection between these two facts. And in fact, in low dimensions, there are even some counterexamples, but they are somewhat subtle in the sense they are related to the duality between boson and fermions in some special systems. In two dimensions, it's well known that bosons and fermions can be dualized. And so one can use Bose-Fermi duality to give counterexamples to this. In three dimensions, it's known that if you couple bosons to Chern-Simons fields, you can get some kind of fermionic behavior, and this is also being studied in detail in this paper. However, here, yes.
The non-Poisson isn't just common theory, but we don't have it fixed values of stellar.
Well, so 1 plus 1 is subtle for the reason you're saying. So in that case, basically, you can show that if you take bosons at finite density and you consider the fermion description of them, then you will have some kind of Fermi gas because of the reason you're saying.
Okay, but then, yeah, I can just do the reason.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of, yeah.
Yeah, so, I'm kind of, don't see why you need to do that. I can just
well, the dynamics of the bosons at low energy will be strongly coupled if you don't dualize.
Okay, I see.
So you cannot make a definite state. But yeah, we can.
Yeah, I see.
Anyway, in three dimensions, the statement is non-trivial, and it's known that if you take scalars coupled to gauge fields with Chern-Simons terms, it's possible to have an effective fermionic behavior. So this question I'm asking is non-trivial there. It's not true. However, I want to ask it for systems of scalars only without gauge fields. And in this case, we think that there should be a connection. So in order to try to address this question, we set up the following computation. Consider a complex scalar in more than two dimensions, exactly for the reason Sergei was mentioning. In this case, you can consider a complex scalar with some arbitrary interaction potential. I will be completely agnostic about the form of this potential. Other than that, it's U1 symmetric. So, most of the times, I will assume that these admits a Taylor expansion around zero, starting at quartic order, just for regularity. And now we want to compute the one loop effective action. Instead of computing it just for the phonons, we want to compute it also for the radial mode. And we want to understand whether the ground state of this system at finite density always gives you symmetry breaking or not. So how do you do this? Well, first of all, to put the system at finite charge density, we need to project on the ground state of this Hamiltonian at finite density. And to do so, you consider the generalized Hamiltonian H minus mu Q minus mu J0. And you add an I epsilon term, not for H, but for this finite mu Hamiltonian. And this I epsilon term in the Hamiltonian formalism, which will project on the ground state of H mu. And then if you go back to the Lagrangian formalism, you find that you get a finite mu Lagrangian, which has this form, where this potential depends on the interaction potential, and there's also some three-level mu dependence, plus some I epsilon terms. And the structure of these I epsilon terms is important, because it tells you that in this field basis, where the Lagrangian is mu dependent, the I epsilon term in the Lagrangian is projecting on time and space independent configuration. Because the I epsilon term proportional to the kinetic terms is positive definite. And so what matters is this three-level effective potential, mu-dependent effective potential. And so when mu, at three-level, when mu is larger than m, you will have spontaneous symmetry breaking, and this I epsilon term will project exactly on this ground state. Notice that one could perform some field redefinition trying to get rid of the mu dependence in this Lagrangian. However, this field redefinition would change the I epsilon term, and the new I epsilon term will project on time-dependent configurations. So we think that working in this field basis is more convenient because it allows you to ask questions by just looking at the effective potential instead of the effective action. Okay. So what I will do is compute the one loop quantum effective potential in this theory. Yes.
Understand. The previous argument is classical, right?
Well, I mean, the fact that this should project it on time-independent configuration should still be valid.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's three-level, right? Or it can be also
fine. Well, if you want to, if you want, we see that it's true at tree level, and we assume that it's true at loop level, and then we self-consistently check that it's a good assumption.
Yeah, I understand. It's not a general proof for like string level series.
No. Now, what I will prove in this case is just one loop.
Mm-hmm.
It would be interesting to have non-perturbative state, but we don't have it. So, as I was saying, because of the reason I was highlighting, it's enough to compute the one loop effective potential at finite mu. Now, compared to the previous computation, I'm including also the radial mode. The reason is that if you don't assume spontaneous symmetry breaking, you're not allowed to integrate out the radial mode. So we want to include it. And what we want to do, the goal is to check if at one loop, finite density always implies spontaneous symmetry breaking. And mathematically, what you do is the following. You have this generating functional for correlators. And you can show that, as is well known for from functional methods in quantum field theory, basically the minimum, the expectation value of the field is corresponds to the value of the field which minimizes the effective potential. And moreover, from this, from the previous formulation, you can show that the expectation value for the charge is given just by a derivative, by a mu derivative of the generating function. This comes simply from the fact that in the path integral, I inserted mu just by this coupling. So when I take derivatives with respect to mu, I'm just bringing down one charge insertion. So this expectation value is just given by a mu derivative of the generating functional. And you can show that this is just the mu derivative of the effective potential evaluated at phi min. Okay. So what I will do is the following. I will try to see whether you can have a non-zero charge density at zero phi or not. Okay. Whether you can have finite density with zero symmetry breaking or not. And I will also try to derive other statements, but this is the first step. So now the question I was asking can be rephrased as this. Assume that at mu equals zero, there is no spontaneous symmetry breaking. So at zero charge, the expectation value of the field is zero. Then we ask, is it true that when mu is larger than some critical value, so that the charge density is non-zero, is it true that the expectation value of the field is also non-zero? So from this expression, which I just showed you, this amounts to asking to whether the derivative of the effective potential with respect to mu at zero phi, whether it's zero or not. Okay. If it's zero, then it means that finite density implies spontaneous symmetry breaking. Okay. And if this is the case, then one can ask additional questions. The first is, what is the critical value of mu, which gives you a finite density? And we'll find that at one loop for arbitrary interactions, it's always true that the critical value of mu is the pole mass. This is valid in arbitrary dimensions larger than 2. And one can ask if one can quantify the amount of symmetry breaking by relating the symmetry breaking scale to the value of the charge density. And I will try to tell you how to do this. Yes.
So that makes your test non-trivial, right? Because
yes.
This local summation can actually change the structure of minimum of the potential.
Yeah, exactly. Especially in the low density limit, when you are close to threshold, it's not clear whether the fact that whether it's possible to have an expectation value for one of the two operators and not for the other or not. So yeah, it's not trivial. So we run the usual kind of Kalman-Weinberg computation, but in this case, because of the spontaneous breaking of Lorentz symmetry from these chemical potential terms, the loop integrals that you have to compute are more complicated. In particular, there is this term which depends on the chemical potential. So the kind of technical steps in the computations are a little bit more complicated than the usual ones. But you can show that the effective potential can always be expressed as this kind of integral, where m square is just a given function of the UV potential, and g square is another given function. And we are able to compute analytically this, and we will use a dimreg, and as I was saying, the counter terms needed are exactly those that you expect from the mu equals zero theory, which is a non-trivial consistency check. So I don't show you the intermediate steps, but the results in d equal 3 is this expression, whereas in d equal 4 is this other expression. And I don't want to stress too much the form of this expression, but it's non-trivial that from these explicit results, we can derive a lot of non-trivial statements. So notice that here, again, there are these upper geometric functions are appearing. And we will be able, actually, to connect this approach to the previous computation and do some non-trivial checks also in this way. So from these explicit expressions that I showed you here, and from the form of m squared and g squared, you can show easily that the value of the effective potential at phi equals 0 is mu independent. Therefore, this derivative is 0. And therefore, at one loop, finite density always implies spontaneous symmetry breaking. This follows from the explicit expression that I showed you. And moreover, one can try to understand what is the critical value of mu. And we can show that it's actually the pole mass. In order to show this, you ask that the finite density is larger than 0. This corresponds to having this inequality. And through a series of straightforward but kind of non-trivial steps, which I can show you, but I'm skipping here, you can show that this results in the condition mu square larger than the pole mass. Okay. So these are general results at one loop for arbitrary interactions, okay, perturbative. Okay. Now, since this was a perturbative result, maybe it's not totally satisfying. It's just a one loop result. So we were trying to find some way to say more. And something you can do is consider an ON model. In particular, I focus on the d equal 3 case, where this ON model is fully well-defined at the non-perturbative level, because the quartic interaction is asymptotically free in three dimensions. And you can consider the ON vector model at large n at finite chemical potential. So this model was studied at zero chemical potential, was solved by Coleman, Gross, Politzer, in the 70s, but the finite mu version was not studied as far as we can tell. And you can generalize what they did, and you can introduce some Arbat-Svetonovich field, and you can show that the model in the large n limit can be solved exactly. You can just do some one loop at integral, and that's it. And so what we find that the leading order in 1 over n, but to all orders in the coupling, is that the effective potential, the quantum effective potential is this form. And also in this case, we find remarkably this connection between finite density and spontaneous symmetry breaking. And we also find that the critical value of the chemical potential is the pole mass. So this holds non-perturbatively at leading order in 1 over n in this model. Okay. So having some faith or some trust in the fact that finite density is accompanied, it always comes hand in hand with the spontaneous symmetry breaking, then we would like to quantify it. And in order to do so, we need some kind of physical definition of symmetry breaking scale. And one way to do so is considering the superfluid phonon EFT, the P of X theory, and defining the symmetry breaking scale similarly to what we do in pion physics. One way to define the pion decay constant is as a coefficient in the Carrel-Lagrangian. So here we define the symmetry breaking scale for the phonon fields as the coefficient of the gradient pi square term in the phonon effective Lagrangian. And from the P of X, you find that this definition is basically tells you that the symmetry breaking scale it satisfies this relation. On the other hand, from the current for the shift symmetry, for the U1 symmetry, you can find also the charge in the in the P of X theory, and this the charge is given by this other expression. So you have some non-trivial relation between the charge, the chemical potential, and the symmetry breaking scale. Okay, and by playing with this relation, there are some non-trivial steps, but it's quite straightforward. You can derive some relations and bounds on the symmetry breaking scale as a function of the charge. So in particular, by using these relations and the definitions of some speed and so on, one finds that in the small density limit, which corresponds to mu close to the critical value, the decay, the symmetry breaking scale is related to the charge density by this formula. Notice that the leading term has this universal form. So it's 1 over the pole mass times Q. So it's linear and the coefficient is exactly determined by the pole mass. The sub-leading term has a slightly more complicated expression. This coefficient can be related to the derivative of the sound speed with respect to Q in 0. But it's another universal coefficient that, in principle, can be measured experimentally and can be checked. And notice that this relation I'm presenting here do not assume weak coupling. We are just working at the level of the P of X theory. So the UV theory could even be strongly coupled. So this is a non-trivial prediction for the scaling of the symmetry breaking scale as a function of the charge density. Moreover, one can derive some non-trivial in general bounds on this symmetry breaking scale, since the positivity of the sound speed implies a general upper bound, which is just the corrections to these low density scalings are always negative. And so the symmetry breaking scale is bounded by this value.
So the physical minimum of the symmetry breaking scale, how would we measure it?
Sorry,
can you repeat? How would we measure the symmetry breaking scale? It's something related to equation state of the fluid.
Yeah. So it's this derivative, if you want. Yeah. Yeah, you can measure the pressure at different densities, and you can interpolate and find the derivative. Okay, and so this is in the low density limit. Now the high density limit is slightly less universal in the sense that there is a non-trivial assumption, which is if you assume that the superfluid EFT flows to a conformal superfluid, then you can find also a scaling relation at high densities. But this assumption is non-trivial because we found examples, and I think this was not pointed out in the literature before, but we found examples where the UV limit of a superfluid is not a conformal superfluid, even if the UV theory flows to a conformal field theory in the UV. And I can tell you more. Basically, this is the case of super-normalizable theories. In super-normalizable theories, the UV fixed point is a free theory. So whenever you include the chemical potential perturbations, the free theory is destabilized, and the interactions stabilize the theory. But since all the interactions were relevant, this introduces some dimensionful scale. So the superfluid EFT that you get is not that of a conformal superfluid. But under the assumption of a conformal superfluid, you get this universal scaling relation, where this again, this coefficient is an non-trivial prediction.
So basically, to linear, you don't get any fluid at all, right? And even because the series is free, so you cannot have a collective behavior. Is it right?
Well, if you put it at finite density, you will.
But they will be suppressed by the by what? By the density, right? It will be like 1 over density or something.
What would be like?
Perhaps the symmetry breaking scale will be 1 over density. No,
you find something similar, but it's just the exponent which will be different.
But it's still positive.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, like one example is exactly this theory I was mentioning here. This theory is super normalizable. And we find that the UV behavior is described by a similar formula, but with a different exponent. Okay, but let me try to conclude. The last In the last couple of slides, I just wanted to connect with what I told you in the first part of the talk. So now I computed the quantum effective potential, including the radial mode. Before, instead, I was computing the effective action for the phonons only. It turns out that there is a way to connect the two. So in particular, there is a way to recover the P of X starting from the full quantum effective potential. And since we computed this for arbitrary potential, for arbitrary interactions in arbitrary dimensions, basically this computation generalizes the computation I showed you in the first part of the talk. So specializing to the phi to the fourth theory, of course, we recover what I showed you before. So it's a non-trivial check because the computations are done completely independently and differently. But the general results that we obtain are the following. So the P of X of a superfluid in odd dimensions coming from some UV potential V is given by this expression. So the one loop correction is universal, and it only depends on the second derivative of the UV potential at the three-level minimum. The same property is true for the in D equal 4. So odd dimensions are simpler because there are no logarithmic divergences at one loop. So you don't need to worry about renormalization in the MS bar C. In even dimensions, you need to renormalize, and this is you need to do it case by case, D equal 4, 6, 8. But this is the general expression, and as I was saying, this reproduces the previous result in a particular limit, in the limit in which you take this potential to be justified to the 4. Okay. And now we can use these general results to do an additional check, so which I think is kind of cute. In particular, you can consider the lambda phi to the 6 model now in three dimensions. And this model is a conformal to one loop. And it was studied in these papers. Sorry. It was studied in this paper of Badel, Rattazzi, Cuomo, and I think Monin. In which basically they were computing the scaling dimensions for the lowest dimensional charge n operator of a CFT associated to this model. And what we find is that the one loop P of X is given as the form of a conformal superfluid, which is X to the 3 halves in three dimensions. And the coefficient admit a Taylor expansion in the coupling. So the first term is the 3 level. What we are computing analytically is the one loop contribution. Okay. From this one loop contribution, you can relate it to the coefficient which characterizes the leading order scaling dimension of large charge operators in the associated CFT. And this coefficient was computed using the large charge expansion through a numerical fit. And what these guys found was -0.065313313. And remarkably, the analytic computation matches these coefficients to all digits. So it's a non-trivial check of both computations. So yeah, this is just to show how these kind of relativistic superfluid computations can be related to the large charge to the study of the large charge sector of conformality theories. And with this, I will conclude, leave you with my summary, and thank you for your
attention.
Well, in principle, so I think in principle this is something that one could test. The fact that the coefficient is the pole mass is a non-trivial.
Pole mass, you measure.
Yeah, I mean. For instance, in cold atoms, you could think of a system of cold atoms, which at zero density, you know the pole mass of the atoms. you know, the scattering lengths and the masses. And then you can put them at finite but small density and imagine measuring the. Sorry. Well, this is the density. It's a, you measured the density. The symmetry breaking scale is related to a derivative of the pressure as a function of the density. So if you can measure the pressure as a function of the density, you can measure its derivative. I need to think about it. I don't want to commit, but yeah. Well, this is the derivative of the pressure as a function of the chemical potential, which is related to the density by this relation. I mean, you need to be to self-consistently solve things, but basically this is the charge density. And if you're able to measure this derivative as a function of this, then you can extract this parameter, in principle, you can check. Okay. I see.
Electrons.
I see.
There. So that.
Nice. Yeah. Also, let me say that maybe this is also kind of an experimental test. But yeah.
The previous point. So.
So I'm not sure. So here we are working at zero temperature. You are still. You can still think of going in the large number of parts. Yeah, you can still take some thermodynamic limit. But yeah, I didn't think much about that. I don't know, honestly. But on the other end, here you can compute a lot. So I mean, I think the predictions are still there. I don't know if some of them can be inferred by thermodynamics, but sometimes thermodynamics just gives you inequality. It's not always equality. So I don't know. Maybe this is more kind of related to some kind of thermodynamics.
Yeah.
So,
how people know these parameters that are for
So definitely. So there are models of inflations which are driven by superfluids, and then. About Hubble tension, I don't know about any attempt. But there have definitely been attempts to apply this to the long distance behavior of dark matter, of light dark matter. In particular, there has been the work of Justin Corey at UPenn, which tried to cook up models of superfluid dark matter. I mean, I don't know how the constructions are solid or not, but they're kind of inspired by this kind of effective theories. Necessarily, it depends on the p of x that you take. I don't know what is the p of x that they assume. The pressure is not exactly the same as the sound speed, so I don't know. But yeah, I think that the, for instance, in the case of inflation, there are constraints on the sound speed. If you take an inflation driven by superfluid, then some observables will depend on the sound speed, and there will be constraints. The kind of relativistic sound speed limit, I don't think it's super constrained. But I have to check this. But yeah, Yeah, something else one can do is, so there is actually something called the Li Huang Yang relation by T.D. Li, Xian Yang, and Kerson Wang, which relates the basically the it gives you a relation between the energy density and the charge density. So I didn't reproduce it here, but basically you can consider take the low density limit Q goes to zero, and you can compute a similar kind of expansion relating the energy density rho in the energy momentum tensor to the charge density. And they did this in some kind of toy model with rigid spheres in non-relativistic case. They were finding some behavior which is measured experimentally, and in our case we get we reproduce that behavior in the lambda phi to the fourth, and this is a signal I think of universality, which I think it would be worth exploring further. But we also compute relativistic corrections. So I mean, I think it's hard to measure that in the lab, but in principle it's a prediction. And I mean, maybe also these models can be relevant also for the phenomenological descriptions of neutron stars, where astrophysicists think that there is a superfluid phase in the inner core. Well, the fundamental degrees of freedom are quarks, or you know, neutrons, but it's an emergent low energy phase, so it should still be described as some kind of P of X. It's not free. It's a strongly interacting kind of finite density. Yeah. I think what they have in mind is kind of QCD at finite density. It's a low. So if you compare temperature with density, you find that temperature is low in the neutron star compared to the density. You can kind of describe it as a finite density state of QCD. So it's possible that some kind, it's not, I'm not saying that this model directly applies to that, but it's possible that some kind, this can give a new viewpoint also to some effective models that try to model this. Well, the baryon number, for instance, or some other internal thing. It depends if you look at calm condensation. There are different phases people consider. But it's some it's a global symmetry of the Lagrange. One of the flavor symmetries or but
is there one more question?